What's up, everybody? It's your boy Brandon back with a very special edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Preston Pish in the his house. We talk about the Hong Kong Bitcoin ETF, how Bitcoin will respond in a recession, and much, much more. So stay tuned for another action-packed episode. And before you do anything, smash that subscribe button wherever you're listening to this podcast. Help your boy out and continue to tune on in. And lastly, it is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. It's strictly the opinion of Preston and myself. And are you looking to get your Bitcoin off an exchange? You need to store your seed phrase on the most hard surface possible in order to avoid losing that seed phrase and the hardest money possible. And where can you do that? You can do that at Stampseed. Check out stampseed.com. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 15% off. They are my guys over at Stampseed, so go check them out. They're the best. They got a sick hammer that comes with it and everything you could possibly need, so check them out. And where do I get all the information for this podcast? It's Bitcoin News. I go and check them and read them every single day when I'm looking for a big article. And I sign up for their newsletters because I get everything in a nice summarized way every Monday morning. So check it out. Links in the show notes. And lastly, shout out to Brandon Gentile, the man, the myth, the legend behind Bitcoin trading cards. I had him previously on the pod. And yeah, he donated to the Geyser Fund. You guys should check it out. If you would like a shout out on the State of Bitcoin podcast, you can donate to the Geyser Fund. Or you could just donate to the Geyser Fund to help support the cause, help your boy out, help me take this thing to the moon. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the episode. Whoosh. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Preston Pish in the house, co-founder of TIP, overall just like one of the greatest voices in Bitcoin. He's been doing the podcasting game for a very, very long time. So Preston, thanks so much for joining the show.
Brandon, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Awesome stuff. Well, I want to dive right into it because, you know, you talk to a lot of traditional finance people, you know, with the We Study Billionaire podcast, and you have that kind of background. It's interesting how you got into Bitcoin through that way. But, you know, there seems like there's a little bit of a dichotomy between the traditional finance world and the Bitcoiners that we all know and love here at the State of Bitcoin podcast, where traditional finance sees inflation kind of floating steady. You know, like the 3.6% is the latest CPI print. And, you know, Bitcoiners obviously, you know, are more of the Main Street people who see, you know, the effects of inflation on the day-to-day basis. And they, you know, think inflation is running rampant. And obviously there's a lot of causes for that. So I want to ask you straight up, like, where do you think we are with inflation? Have we, you know, settled it? Is it just stagflation? Like, kind of describe to us how you're seeing this current inflationary process.
Let's talk about if we were going to financially engineer inflation in our, inside of our country, and let's say you and I were running a country, and we were going to just engineer inflation data that we wanted. And if we were even going to go further upstream than doing that, which I'll give you an example of us working together to engineer something. But the question would be, why would we be so interested in doing something like that? And the reason you would be so interested in doing something like that is because literally everything on the planet starts with what is the inflation rate? And then let me construct the valuation of everything, equities, stocks, bonds, commodities, all of it is looking at that inflation rate and then constructing the cost of capital as some type of premium above what everybody thinks the inflation rate is. And so the reason inflation is so incredibly hard to wrap your head around is because if you're looking at a specific thing, let's say we're looking at the price of corn or we're looking at the price of wheat, you name it, whatever commodity. If that is in your basket that is being determined what inflation is, and let's say you and I have a strong incentive to control the price of wheat for whatever reason, and we go in there, we create all these different policies, and we have a printing press in the background, and we turn that thing on, and then we allocate, we create certain policies, and we do these things that keep the price of wheat pretty flat, maybe goes up a little bit. And we're saying, well, the CPI gauge is wheat is one of the primary inputs. And if we do this, and in the background, this printing press is running crazy, and the prices of let's say everything else is going crazy, and we're just using wheat as our gauge for CPI. Okay. Everything else is going crazy, but the government's saying, look right here in this basket right here, it's only wheat. And that price is pretty stable. Therefore, the price of fixed income bonds should not be impacted much because inflation's only 2%. It's not 10%. Because look at this gauge right here. It's saying it's two. And so if I'm a bond investor and I think that inflation is only 2% because I'm looking at a broken gauge, all of a sudden I might only be willing to the price of those bonds might only sell at a 4% yield, and people think that that's reasonable because inflation's 2% and they're getting an additional 2% kicker for, you know, investing in that bond. And then you go from bonds to equities, and the equities are priced at a premium over the fixed income. And you can see how everything is constructed, starting with this keystone metric of CPI, the inflation data. And so this is why it's so difficult. You'll hear Saylor say, inflation is a scalar. It's a vector of all these different metrics. And it is. And that's why it's so difficult for people to wrap their head around, because what they'll do is they'll look at the government and be like, well, they got these 15 different things in the basket, or however many there are. And they'll say, all of these things are suggesting that inflation's only 4 or 5%, the number that you said when you asked the question. That's the number they want you to think that it is, because if it is, then everything else can be priced more appropriately, more air quotes, appropriately to those numbers that they're feeding you. Now, what is the actual inflation rate? Because as this ebbs and flows, and as the dynamics change through time, sometimes that wheat price might spike up to 3 or 4%, and then they're like, oh God, we got to get it under control, or we just need to remove it completely from the basket altogether, right? Which is something they've been doing for decades, is if they can't get it under control, well, then we're just going to remove it or weight it differently so that it looks like it's not as impactful. So that's the scenario that's happening with inflation. Now, where this also gets really, really, really confusing is you're dealing with fiat currencies where none of them are pegged. Okay. So let's say that the euro was not debasing or creating more monetary units at all. It was just pegged, it was fixed, and they weren't competing with the US and every other nation to debase their currency to attract business into their local region. Because when the currency is weak, everybody wants to buy goods and products from that country, which attracts foreign capital into that country and then inflates their GDP numbers and all this other stuff. So what you have is this race to debase between nation states, which then when you're looking at it in relative terms, it looks like, oh, well, the dollar's hasn't been that strong or that weak relative to the euro. It fluctuated by 10%, and then it came back down, and then it went up, and then it went back down by 10%. And it's this giant relative game of all of them just obliterating their currencies and doing these policy maneuvers in order to make the inflation look like it's lower. But if you actually had a unit, a monetary unit, that could not be debased or created more of, that the governments could not step in and manipulate through some type of derivatives exchange. And I'm describing gold here. Like, people think that this is gold, but they papered over gold through derivatives, cash settled derivatives. And that's how they were able to mask a lot of this in the gold market and it not to be viewed as an inflation gauge. So that arrives at Bitcoin. And that's where it is very, very different. And, There's an article that I have pinned on my Twitter account, and it talks into all these ideas in probably a much more organized manner than I just did describing it vocally. But you can create inflation three different ways, or you can kind of see inflation change in three different ways. The first one is just through supply destruction. So, like, let's say you were on an island and a natural disaster occurred, and there was all sorts of destruction and whatnot. And then like all of a sudden generators, the inflation on a generator goes through the roof. As long as the monetary units don't change and there's not more created, you're going to see the price spike. You're going to see changes and reorganization of all the material on that island. And then you're going to watch the prices of them gradually come back down as stability would be achieved and recaptured within that island. But that would be a short-term inflationary impact. And so people will get that confused with what is inflation. The other one is supply destruction through policy. If a country mandates that everyone now only works 10 hours instead of 40 hours, well, you're going to have a whole lot less of a certain good because people are only working 25% of the time as opposed to what they were before. So that policy decision can create an inflationary run on certain desirable products and services because the policy is, and I would argue that a lot of this ESG stuff might actually be some form or some strange form of these types of activities where the policy decisions are actually creating this consternation and churn in the prices of everything. And then the last and the most important one, because this is the one that actually has like immutable impacts as to the inflation manifesting itself somewhere, most likely in very desirable things, whether that's energy, healthcare, education, right? The things that people actually really, really want. And that's the unit being added into the system. So if we have a million fiat units, and then tomorrow we have 2 million fiat units, that debasement or that additional 100% move in the number of units that are in the system has to figure out where it needs to go to create an inflationary impact. And where's it going to go? It's going to go to the place that's where the goods or services are most desirable. And so when we look at policy, where if you're a policymaker and you're trying to mask all this and you're trying to hide it all, where are you going to do it most aggressively? You're going to do it most aggressively where the goods and services are most desirable. And what do we see? We see exactly that. And so when we're talking inflation and we're talking about this number that's getting published, there's a lot to wrap your head around. There's a lot going on. And it's no surprise that it's so confusing to so many people.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, like you said, right? I mean, it's obviously it's a manipulated number. I mean, with data, I feel like you could kind of see whatever you would like, right? I mean, I don't know. I would always get in an argument with friends back at home, especially about sports, just random things. Like I think in like 2018, I made a big argument with them that Mitch Trubisky was a better quarterback than Dak Prescott, and one's basically out of the league and the other one's still playing. So, I mean, you could kind of just see what you want at a certain extent. But, you know, you're kind of describing like inflationary pressures and things like that. So why do you think that there's this disconnect when it comes to, you know, maybe like the traditional finance where we're kind of, you know, maybe they're describing the economy more as, you know, stagflationary, you know, that things aren't necessarily as bad as maybe the Bitcoiners see, where the Bitcoiners are seeing a lot of the cracks under the surface, whether it's, you know, personal savings being depleted, credit card usage going skyrocketing and everything like that. Like, and these cracks aren't necessarily beginning to surface just yet, or at least it appears that way. So, you know, I guess, is it just still the facade of the economy, the fiat facade that's kind of, you know, making a lot of people think that everything is okay and that, you know, it's not necessarily cracking and going to be in a recession right away? Or is it basically just a matter of time at this point, and you know, something's going to make the make this economy crack?
It's recency bias. So when you look at any developed nation state that's basically been controlling the purse strings of society for the last 40 years, all they know is that interest rates have just continued to go down through policy. And because they continued to go down for 40 years straight, and basically from 1981 up until the 2020 COVID crisis, that whole period of time, if interest rates are going down, the value and prices of everything just keep going up. So if you're in one of these G7s and you were in real estate, or you name it, equities, bonds, I don't care which financial instrument you're talking about, the price just kept going up. And the reason it kept going up is because the the illusion that inflation was going down. And, you know, through all intents and purposes, when you're flooding the system with additional capital and it's going into R&D to make the exploration and finding of oil cheaper and easier to find, you will see the inflationary impacts go lower. Jeff Booth talks about this idea, this deflationary impact of technology through and through. But what happens is when you exercise this manipulation of flooding the system with free keystroke money that's been entered into the system, that's then invested into better and better technology, what happens also is the consolidation of equity. Fewer and fewer people own everything. And then the challenge is how do these fewer and fewer entities that are literally controlling every supply chain and everything on the planet, how do they deal with a breaking point when they're trying to jam so much productivity through a soda straw? What you do is you start to get the breakdown of things. You get the breakdown of supply chains because you've literally pushed the system to the limits of the physical capacity of what physical reality can handle. And so then you start to get an unwind of this. I would argue that that's exactly what we've been seeing since COVID 2020, because what's happening is when you break up the planet into two different regions, you have the net producers and you have the net consumers. And what's happening is the producers, the ones that are producing in excess, they're being told by the consumers, which is basically the whole G7 and NATO and the whole, you know, Western world, they're all net consumers. Those net consumers are saying, I'm going to pay you for all these physical raw goods and services and all these things that you're providing in excess, and I'm going to pay you with these more made-up keystroked monetary units that are backed by nothing for this overconsumption that we're going to continue to do. And what they're starting to say is, no, you're not. We're done with this. It's over. And so why are you seeing a war in the Ukraine? Why are you seeing interesting things happening with the supply chains and boats wrecking into bridges and factories being lit on fire? And now you got Iran and Israel. And why is all that happening? Well, it's all happening because the net producers of the world are sick and tired of receiving the monetary units that continue to be keystroked into the system, and they know they're worthless. And so now you're having a breakdown of this global cooperation that I would argue was at its pinnacle going into COVID 2020. And now you're starting to see physical breakdown in supply chains and physical breakdown in the underpinnings of the monetary imaginary units that used to be the underpinning of all of this this global cooperation and just-in-time supply chain management and all that kind of stuff. It's really bad for prices when all of the sudden the inflation starts really manifesting itself in a way that you can't hide it anymore through policy and theatrics. And, you know, you were talking about controlling CPI. I can make CPI any number you want. I can make CPI negative. I could make CPI 20%. Just give me the basket and let me adjust the magnitudes of the individual items inside the basket, and I can make CPI anything you want.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the, I guess, the scary thing when it comes to this data that the government is producing, right? Because, I mean, you know, everybody's kind of feeling that CPI go higher, right? I mean, you know, you brought up real estate, you brought up other things. I mean, I've seen, you know, real estate numbers in certain cities in the past 5 years where the house has doubled. And you know, and if that rate were to continue, basically like $1 million homes would be worth well over $1 billion here in 50 years, which is just absolutely scary, right? But it's not because the houses are getting any better, right? I mean, I'm sitting in a 100-year-old house here and that value has gone up significantly, but it's not because, you know, it's and anything new cutting edge or anything like that. It's because the underlying currency is just continuing to get devalued. But you brought up supply chains, right? So, I mean, obviously the net,
net producers.
The net producers are getting basically tired of, you know, accepting these cut bucks, right? The fiat bucks that Powell is essentially just going through that money printer. So, you know, in a sense, it seems like something has to break and that, you know, basically we're going to be at odds here because, you know, fiat kind of, I guess, encourages chaos, right? Whether it's war, COVID, shutting some things down, you know, you brought up the bridges collapsing and everything like that. In order to kind of put on the illusion to, you know, in a sense, pull these puppet strings in the background. So, you know, I guess, like, how would we get to, you know, I guess, like, you know, the golden arch is the Bitcoin standard that everybody describes without some total chaos ensuing? Do you see us kind of going that, where the current system has to just, you know, fail and everything has to kind of crash in order for us to get to, you know, greener pastures on the other side? Or is there some sort of way that we could get to, you know, maybe mixing and colliding these worlds and kind of, you know, do the grassroots movement, go to a Bitcoin standard and kind of, you know, I guess, slowly merge onto to that path where it's not complete and total destruction?
They are two sides of the same coin, unfortunately. One of the things that I think is important for people to just kind of think about, we see this on an individual level, and it's just a fractal at a nation state level. And so if you went to a child and you were like, okay, I'm going to pay you an allowance for work that you performed. And let's say the child was out there doing like real work and beneficial value added type work. Then the child was like, yeah, I just don't really want to do the work anymore. I just want you to like give me the money. And as a parent, let's say you did give them the money, even though they weren't doing the work. And then it was like, now I just don't want the money. I want like even more than that. I just want you to like do the work now. And I want you to continue to pay me. And like this breakdown in incentives is what I'm talking about. And so when we look at nation states that are just now just handing out money to people, like you don't have to do any work. If you have a pulse, we're going to give you money. What you're doing is you're warping incentives and you're warping proper asset allocation. So like if I get $1,000 and I haven't done anything for it, am I going to go out there and spend it in a thoughtful, meaningful way that then compounds value added activities? Or am I going to use it in a very consumer based, consumption based kind of way? And the answer is the latter. And you're doing that at scale. And you're doing it at, you know, I mean, some of the stuff that I heard that like the money that was pumped into the system after COVID and like what they were doing with small businesses and things like, holy mackerel, man. I mean, it is totally nuts. And it wasn't just in the U.S., it was literally globally. So when you have such a breakdown in the allocation of capital because you can just keystroke it, now you're setting up this do loop of in a fractional reserve system that's all credit based, and they're buying things in the impairment that's going to spiral out of this because there was no fundamental grounding in proper investment. So like you give me $100,000, I'm going to do deep due diligence on how I'm going to allocate that and invest that $100,000. But if you're a person that doesn't think in these terms and you just like, oh, I got $100,000. Now I can go buy that Mercedes-Benz I wanted, as opposed to how I can employ it back into the system because I worked very hard to make the $100,000. That's the difference of what I'm talking about from a nation state level. And so when you understand how fractional reserve banking works, it goes through impairment cycles where the fiat gets invested into the system. There's bad decisions. There's a lot of counterparty risk. It spirals. It reaches contagion. And then all those monetary units start to explode. They start to go to zero because they were employed improperly without thoughtful diligence in thinking. Okay. So you're making bad investments. Those bad investments spiral into contagion and those units blow up. And so then after they blow up, what do they have to do? What do they have to do? They have to create even 10 times as many monetary units to then stuff back into the system, right? And then the whole thing just keeps the compound on itself over and over again with worse and worse capital allocation into the next cycle. And I would argue that it's starting to get out of control at this point.
Yeah, I mean,
Brandon, hold on 1 second. I'm sorry to put an edit into your show. My headphones went out. I wasn't even hearing what was being said here. So I got to swap my headphones real fast. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, no problem.
Okay. I can hear again. So sorry. Yeah.
No, no problem. You can hear. Can you hear me fine?
Good now. Yeah. Okay,
perfect. All right. Let me put a little clap so I can get it in the audio pretty easily. All right. But, you know, you're kind of describing the total system collapsing here, right? I mean, everything's kind of, you know, going haywire. But, you know, in a sense, too, like, I don't know how we go anywhere from here but down, because, you know, you retweeted a nice chart from Zero Hedge here the other day where it talked about the global change in reserves, right? So, I mean, you could kind of see the cumulative liquidity just going straight down. You can see, you know, the oil reserves is obviously one big aspect of that, where everybody's kind of depleting all of their reserves, but to kind of keep this illusion going. So, you know, with those cracks kind of consuming here, right? I mean, everybody loves to show that the chart in, you know, the rise of the empires, and then it slowly starts to come down, and everybody's showing that the U.S. is kind of coming down here. So, I mean, in a sense, how long do you think we could keep on this facade going until we reach that breaking point of, you know, maybe even going into another currency? Because obviously, you know, BRICS has come along and said some things about, you know, potentially creating their own cryptocurrency. And, you know, there's kind of some way, shape, or form we can get into another, I guess, another facade, another kind of illusion where another a country could come into power. You know, China's obviously been buying up a lot of gold, so maybe China is going to kind of rise up and, you know, make their currency or try to make a case for their currency to become the next global reserve currency. But, you know, the problems would still be underlying here, where everything is kind of, you know, I guess, manipulated by man. So I guess, like, this is a long-winded to say to, you know, with the reserves being depleted, like, where are we going from here?
So the challenge that any country has is trying to convince everybody else to use their currency. So like here in the U.S., am I going to use the yuan? Not a prayer. I'm going to use the yuan. Am I going to use, you know, the Russian ruble? Of course I'm not going to use the Russian. Like, give me a break. And they are looking at, am I going to use the dollar? Look at Russia. Like, we literally just took their entire reserves away from them, the U.S. dollar reserves that they had. So of course not. And so everybody's just scrounging for something that represents monetary units of the work that they performed, the excess work that they performed, that somebody else, some other country can't rug pull them with. And the other challenge that you got in a fractional reserve system is it is completely based on, you have to keep expanding the monetary units in the system. So regardless of whether you're Russia, China, US, Euro, I don't care what it is, those systems are inherently based on having to expand the monetary units. That's not going to win in the face of something that is truly decentralized, truly scarce, that can't be manipulated by an outside entity. It's going to lose. So on the speed, I think the last 4 years have been very demonstrative and very different than what we've seen throughout Bitcoin's history, because leading up to the COVID event, you had the CPI inflation gauges and the global cooperation continue to work, because everybody was of the firm opinion that inflation keeps going down, therefore fixed income yields keep going down, therefore the price of everything keeps going up, and if the price of everything keeps going up, everybody's happy. But since COVID, what have we seen with respect to fixed income? Yields have gone up. In fact, it's been the biggest bond sell-off in the United States in the history of the United States. And I don't think it's even close to being done yet. And if true, that means the prices of everything is going to keep going down because of this hurdle rate that it's real simple. Yields go up, prices go down. That's the math. That's really simple. So when we're looking at if the fixed income market's going to continue to sell off, that means commercial real estate, that means like all of these things are physical things, like very real physical things, are going to continue to have price pressures that, if it's not productive in any kind of way, it's going to get obliterated. If it is productive, then you can't pay a high enough price for it. And this is going to be a really hard dynamic for a lot of people to witness and to experience, because they're going to watch the PEs on like profitable businesses that are value added through depressionary like scenarios, they're going to bid through the roof. They're going to keep running higher. And that's going to be, they're going to melt up, and that's going to be really difficult for people to understand. But three things are really going to run through this in the coming, we'll call it 6 years, coming 6 years to 10 years. Productive equity, like value added equity that is actually generating free cash flows in a depressionary like scenario. Those businesses are going to get bid to the moon. Commodities are going to get bid, like desirable commodities. So energy, food, all that kind of stuff is in fiat terms is going to get bid like crazy. And Bitcoin, it's going to get bid. It's that easy. If it's fixed income related, it's going to just get annihilated. And I think that the timeline, I think you're 6 to 10 years of this, like really kind of unfolding. And it's not linear. This is exponential, what's taking place. And the more volatility you see, the faster it moves all of this along.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we were both in Madeira kind of, we saw Thaler kind of get up there and say that Bitcoin's in the beginning of a crazy 10-year cycle, right? I mean, yeah. We've had BlackRock and we've had, 11 spot ETFs in the US come in. So, with traditional finance kind of dumping, billions and billions of dollars within these spot ETFs and just scooping up all this Bitcoin, do you think that traditional finance is kind of waking up to this fact as well? Yeah. Because you obviously, did the We Study Billionaires show. You studied Warren Buffett. And, I feel like a lot of the traditional, metrics that he would use, like PE ratio, you mentioned, like value investing is almost dead because it's gotten crushed in this past like decade plus where, you're seeing PE ratios just getting valued like through the roof. So I guess it's a two-part question here is like, do you think that because there's so much delusion in the stock market where, you could just throw a dart at the wall and pick some tech stock and it was going to go to the moon, that, traditional finance is finding, I guess, its safe haven within Bitcoin with the spot ETFs? And then, is that kind of the spark that we need? Or I don't know if we necessarily need it, but the spark that's going to cause this 10-year cycle to just, fully embrace Bitcoin. We're not going to see anything quite like this, scooping up as much as Bitcoin as traditional finance has been going into.
I think traditional finance is definitely starting to wake up, and I think that you can say whatever you want about BlackRock and some of the others that launched their ETF products, but for people in traditional finance, this was kind of an alarm bell to say, oh wow, like. Why would BlackRock be doing? I thought Bitcoin was just like a joke. I thought this was just a bunch of like degens, like trading, speculative, imaginary Mario coins. And I think when that approval came out, it was kind of this shock and awe moment in traditional finance of like, well, hold on a second, they wouldn't be doing this unless there was something here. And now I think I think the Hong Kong ETF rollout is also on par with the US ETF rollout in that it's another shot around the world that's like, oh, now Asia wants to play. Like, what the hell is that? And if it's anything even close to the flows that we've seen in the US since that thing was approved, hang on. And so then where does that lead? Let's say that rollout is moderately successful in that they're bringing a lot of flows into the spot. Where I think it goes next is then you're going to start to see hybrid products where it's like, hey, own this ETF that is 98% S&P 500 and 2% Bitcoin. And so then it's going to start getting inserted in these strange and unusual ways where it's basically hedging the dollar into like all these products. I think that's coming next. And then obviously the financialization on top of it. So once you start getting derivatives on top of some of these ETFs, where this is going to get really profound is you're then going to have all the quick money on Wall Street. And what I mean by quick money is they're going long and short simultaneously, and they're just capturing a spread. And that spread might produce a 10% or 20% annualized return by going long and short simultaneously because of the spread from speculators on the product. And what that's doing is that's even, it's even putting more and more profound amounts of capital all on top of this, and it's making it really liquid. And so, like, what does liquidity bring to something? When you have something that has a deep amount of liquidity, now all of a sudden it becomes pristine capital. It becomes pristine collateral to be used. So then Bitcoin starts becoming this collateral for, like, everything. So these are some of the things that are on the horizon in short order, like the coming 2 years. And I also found it interesting that in Asia, they're rolling out in-kind spot ETFs as opposed to the cash settled ETFs here in the US, which from a tax standpoint is way more advantageous than what they're doing in Asia, which then creates competition and politics back here in the US to start doing in-kind redemption. And it gets really interesting really fast, because now you're starting to see this thing really play out on a global scale. So yeah, I think all of this is an accelerative to where we go next. I think based on the fractals that we've seen in Bitcoin over the past decade, nobody should be surprised that now it's at this stage. And when you contrast all of this performance that you're going to see in the coming 2 years against the performance in fixed income, hang on to your hats, folks, hang on to your hats, because it's about to get crazy.
Yeah, and I agree 100%, and I'm sure, you know, a lot, majority of the listeners agree as well. But, you know, I've kind of played with this little thought experiment. You know, the past cycle, we saw a lot of, you know, nefarious players, right? We saw FTX, we saw Celsius, we saw a lot of these, you know, exchanges essentially issue paper Bitcoin, right? I mean, obviously the ETFs are going to have a lot harder time to issue some paper Bitcoin because, you know, they're regulated in theory, right, by the SEC. But I don't know, maybe it's a tinfoil hat kind of a thought experiment here, but do you think that there's a way that, you know, obviously traditional finance is adding a ton of liquidity? So, you know, in a sense, they're almost pulling the strings behind the scenes of, like, price manipulation and whatnot. But I mean, do you think that there's a way that they could possibly do that going forward where, you know, they're just such big players, and, you know, because it's a decentralized, you know, commodity and everything like that, and, you know, all the great qualities of Bitcoin, that, you know, the exchange rate, it can be, I guess, somewhat taken over by traditional finance. And that, I mean, plebs at this point, even though we've been able to front run for so long, that, you know, there is some potential blood in the streets if we try to, I guess, play some dangerous games going forward.
So the question is can Bitcoin become like gold, is really the question. And here's why I don't think it can. When we look at the outstanding stock of gold and who squats on the majority of the gold in the world, central banks hold a tremendous amount of the gold stock. And if they're doing that, and then they're papering over top of that in a cash settled derivatives kind of way, that's not spot settled, you are able to deeply hide and mask the underlying spot performance of gold because of where the outstanding stock lies. When we look at Bitcoin, it's very, very different. The people that I know that are squatting on, like, tremendous amounts of Bitcoin are totally psychopathic. And like I'm sure you've seen the meme of, like, the person who's, like, sleeping in this small apartment with the mattress on the floor and a TV with the sailor video on the TV is, like, the meme. And the person has, like, 1,000 Bitcoin. Like, it's pretty close to that. Like, the people that are squatting on a tremendous amount of coins would much rather see, like, Bitcoin completely fail as an experiment and, like, all of it go to zero than to, like, go out and buy, like, a couple yachts or whatever. And so this, because most of these people have been deeply hurt or impacted by the fiat legacy system, and they understand what the actual solution is and the cure. Because of this, and because all of these coins are nested into the hands of these deeply convicted people, good luck controlling the price. And the fact that you got spot ETFs, I think, is going to be really, really difficult, that they're not these cash settled derivatives on top of it, and that the spots were and I don't think Bitcoin's success is pendent on the US making these spot ETF approvals at all. I just think that it accelerates the timeline. I think the timeline would have taken longer if they would have continued to not allow them to be approved. And now that you're coming with a spot in kind redemption kind of thing in Asia, like, hang on, dude, hang on. I don't think that they can. Now they can play games. I will say this, like, when you have killer whales in the market with just enormous amounts of capital, what they can do is they can soak up a ton of spot. They can then use that spot to sell into the market and then buy derivatives that, you know, like a long dated call or something like that, and have tremendous performance because they're playing these games. And they're also looking at, like, where a lot of the derivatives are marked, or the spots that they are, like, maybe they're 5K above, 5K below the current spot. And so they gobble up a bunch of coins and they compress the price down below, and they get an additional sell wave because they were able to compress it down there because they're a whale. Like, these types of activities are definitely going to continue to persist. But what's interesting is the volatility isn't anything that we haven't seen historically in Bitcoin to date. Like, in fact, you might even argue that it's a little subsided from what we've seen, which I think is interesting. And basically demonstrating that they definitely do not have any of this under control, as far as, like, an outside entity, like, taming this market. Yeah.
So, you know, that's a great response. And that's encouraging for somebody listening to this. I think, you know, as we're seeing 11 of these spot ETFs roll out in the US, but, you know, you mentioned something, right? Bitcoiners are psychopaths, right? So, I mean, the hodler behavior, I think, is something that can't be undershot here. And, but we also have the halving coming up. We're recording this on April 16th. The halving's projected to be, you know, the 19th or 20th, sometime around there. But, and a lot of Bitcoiners equate that to, you know, maybe seeing the price run up here. Obviously, you know, there is some supply and demand, things like that, right? But, you know, there's less than 10% of the overall total Bitcoin supply that's left to be mined at this point, right? I mean, obviously, you know, we're not going to see all the 21 million fully be mined until 2135. But, you know, a lot of Bitcoiners, like I said, kind of equate a price potential run up, these 4-year cycles, to be circled around the halving. I personally kind of think it's more around the psychopaths, the hodlers behavior.
Amen.
Yeah. Is that how you kind of equate this?
It's both. Yeah, it's both. You know, normally whenever you're like, is it this or that? It's normally like a qubit, right? Like, it's both. It's two sides of the same coin, and the magnitude kind of shifts throughout time. So, like, when we went through this FTX meltdown, Genesis, like, all of that garbage, you saw price. Those were not prices I was expecting to see on the last cycle. Like, if you would have asked me before last cycle where we would get as a low going through another cycle, I would have probably said, like, I don't know, 40,000-50,000 maybe. The fact that we got down to like 16 was insane to me. Like, I was just salivating. I could not believe that I had another bite at the apple at those prices. And so I think deeply convicted people that understand what this is and that it can't be manipulated. It can be manipulated in the short term, but not in the long term. And so when we saw those prices, I was like, oh my God, I've got to, like, I need to eat ramen every day because I've got to stack this stuff as hard as I possibly can. And I think everybody else that's been in this space for a long period of time, we're thinking on the exact same front. And so when you have individuals that are that deeply convicted, and let me tell you, I'm not an oddity here. Like, I'm just like many, many other people that are producing their own free cash flows, that are just stuffing it into this thing with everything they've got because they inherently understand what they own and they inherently understand the problem that it's solving. So when that happens, the supply suffocation of these coins coming out of the hands of speculators and into, like, long-term holders is such a powerful force for the next cycle. It is like, you know, like if you were going to pack explosives into the side of a mountain to blow it out, like that is what's happening through that deeply convicted sell-off of the speculators that are there just for a quick buck. And these people come in and they soak it all up. And now we're going to the halving, and people will look at that, at the halving, and saying, this is why the price is going up. It's because of the halving. Well, it's a factor. But I would argue that what played out at 16K in the psychopaths that were there with buying it up is just as profound, and maybe even more profound. I don't know, but it's just as important as what the halving event's going to do. So the price starts to run because there's just not enough coins. Then you attract all these speculators in. And so what's going to make it run well into the six figures in dollar terms in the coming year? What's going to do that? The speculators are going to do that because they're going to be fighting over the couple of Bitcoin that remain because all the psychopaths sucked them all out of the market when the price was 16K. And it just goes on and on. And then the cycle, and maybe the speculators are going to overdo it. And, you know, then we'll go from there. We'll see. I think this cycle is very different. I think this cycle is very different because for the first time you actually have bonds. I don't think that the bond market's going to get under control in the coming 10 years. I just think it's going to continue to just get obliterated. And I think they're going to have to continue to step into short duration issuance as opposed to long term. I don't even think they can do long duration issuance anymore. Like, good luck selling those things. Good luck. Because there's just not going to be any buyers. If you're buying long duration debt, like, you're just a total idiot, like massive idiot.
And I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately that there is some people out there still doing that, I think. And, you know, like, if you look at the treasury year yield curve and the, you know, the 30-year bond marks, everything just seems to be kind of like floating around here at like the 4 to 5%. So, you know, we were talking a little bit about pre-show, like, you know, you just think, obviously, you know, bond buyers here, I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking and going through this, but, you know, how does that kind of affect? Do we get a U.S. defaulting kind of situation, or like, where do we go from here?
So let me put it this way. Okay. Some people might be really surprised to hear me say this. So if I was going to be buying, if let's say I didn't believe in Bitcoin and I thought it was terrible and I just would never own it, like, what would I own right now? I would probably own like 3 month, notes, because they're yielding 5.4% right now. If I went and I priced the S&P 500, I would imagine the yield's under that. I would say the yield is like 4 to 3% by owning the S&P 500 right now. So, like, do I want to have my money tied up in 3 month duration returns of 5.4%, or do I want to own this S&P 500 that's priced at like 3%? Like, that's a no brainer. I'm going to buy the 3 month paper. I'm not going to buy the trade, and it's not going to be impacted by inflation because it's only got 3 months of duration. So, like, that's the play. Look at Berkshire Hathaway. What's he doing with all of his money? People will say it's all in cash. It's not in cash. It's in like really short duration notes and bills. And because he won't be in the price point won't be impacted by inflation. And he's just basically banging out like 5% yield, which is, I would argue, 3 to 4% underperformance from the debasement rate, because I would say the debasement rate at this point is like 8 to 9%, maybe going higher, probably going higher. So he's just underperforming it by like 3% or so, which is probably the best place. This sounds crazy. That's the best place to be if you can't be in Bitcoin. So, you know, and if you're buying up like 30-year debt, like, you're just a total idiot. Like, you're going to get annihilated because all that inflation that's coming is just totally going to be priced into the price point of that debt. And like, you're just going to, this is why they had to stand up the backstop facilities, because all these stupid regional banks had like loads of like long duration bonds on their books, and it was just getting obliterated, and it's just getting started. Like, it's just totally getting started. So good luck. Congratulations. You made some really bad, you know, financial decisions and risk management.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, Silicon Valley, and we had a lot of these other banks kind of blow up here in this past year, but I don't know. I mean, it seems like that they're, I guess the illusion is still kind of living on at this point with that, but, mm-hmm. you know, Powell has kind of talked about, you know, potentially lowering interest rates, you know, at some time in the near future. I kind of think it'll happen maybe Q4, maybe even early next year. He's going to try to hold on that higher for longer. Even Biden has come out and said that, you know, the interest rate cut is going to have to, you know, come a little bit later. So like in the next, you know, 6 months to a year or so, we could potentially see that. And, you know, I guess the narrative going around is that, you know, Bitcoiners kind of think that the, you know, Bitcoiners going to shoot up slowly after that, right? Because, you know, generally speaking, risk on assets, right? Generally thrive in a low interest rate environment. But, you know, historically, when we've seen the Fed keep interest rates at a high rate and then they cut, we generally speaking see a recession following that. So I think it is a very interesting cycle that we have here, you know, where we could see Bitcoin potentially, you know, I guess in a bull market during a recession. So do you see it to be kind of in that case, or do you see, you know, Bitcoin not fully, I guess, decoupling yet from the stock market and kind of the overall economy just yet?
Oh, Bitcoin's going to rip. Like coming into the next 12 to 18 months, Bitcoin's going to absolutely rip. Yeah, so like when we're thinking about the them saying they're going to cut rates, they are going to cut the overnight, you know, federal funds rate. What's going to be interesting is like, what are they going to do about the rest of the yield curve? Supposedly, you know, Operation Twist, I think it was 2012, they did Operation Twist, was a demonstration of them stepping into the longer end of the yield curve to try to get it under control and to smooth it out. So it was like completely positively sloped, which banks need to manage their balance sheets. But what's going to be interesting is like, okay, so you're going to cut rates so that you can control the deficit issue. That's why they're going to do it, because they, if they don't do it, like the deficit just continues to blow out like an accelerative pace. But what's happening is the rest of the yield curve is just going to keep selling off through all of this, because as they're doing that rate cut, or like the overnight money is artificially being kept at a price point that incentivizes further and further consumption, and inflation is going to continue to rip because of these decisions. Like, you're going to watch the rest of the yield curve. In my opinion, I think you're going to see the rest of the yield curve continue to sell off like crazy. And like how are you going to finance something long duration if you're a business? That's going to be really difficult and just destructive. So again, it goes back to this idea that if you're a business that's not like constructively making money and adding value and have free cash flows, like it's just going to be like the Grim Reaper showed up. And then for businesses that are, you know, adding value, they're just going to get bid like crazy. And here's the thing. So like when you're looking at the indices, what's driving the indices? The couple companies that have massive market caps are what you're seeing in the indices. So people are going to be looking at the NASDAQ. They're going to be looking at the Dow. They're going to be looking at all these like indices. They're going to be watching them rip like crazy, because the couple companies that are profitable is where like all of this fixed income buying power is going to transmute itself. And they're going to be looking around and like the economy, like their local town, like it's just going to total crap. And they're going to be like, what is happening? I don't understand what's happening. Well, that's what's happening. You're just driving a further and further wedge through society by trying to control the cost of capital and trying to manipulate the fundamental building block of all valuation and all price. It's the ultimate price control. If you're controlling inflation and you're controlling the overnight money rate, like it's truly like trying to do price controls on everything. And I think that's missed on a lot of people. Because like if I told you I'm gonna implement this policy where I'm controlling the price of corn, like you inherently know that that's going to create issues by me stepping in and manipulating that. But what if I said, I'm gonna step in and I'm gonna manipulate the price of everything? That's what they're doing when they're controlling this overnight money rate at a moment where inflation is trying to run, which is you should let those yields blow out even higher to try to get it under control naturally, but they're not going to do that.
And so, yeah, I mean, so then is everything going to break then? I mean, because it seems like, you know,
maybe it already is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, so that's why we find the reserve in Bitcoin, right? I mean, you know, at the end, it can't be manipulated in those interest rates, you know, I mean, at a certain point right now, it's like, all right, everybody's hanging on the words that everything that Jerome Powell says, right? Whether it's whatever bird metaphor you want to use, hawkish, dovish, whatever, the market is swinging one way or the other. It's, you know, in a sense, absolutely ridiculous. But you've been very generous with your time and you're a very well-read individual. So I want, before I let you go, you know, we're describing this Bitcoin bull run in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. That's everything's going to pop. So we're going to have a lot of new people coming in. So if there's a book that you would recommend to kind of get either them started, or, you know, kind of into the Bitcoin mindset where, you know, they kind of think about the hard money principles and what Bitcoin can do for them. What's one starter book that you would recommend to get them going?
I'm going to be hopefully interviewing the author of this book. This book is really profound. I've never recommended this one before. I just had a total mind melt. The Economic Hitman book is absolutely super profound. For anybody that's read any of Alex Gladstein's stuff, Alex covers it, and there's a new version of this called The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So I would highly encourage people. There's like additional chapters in here because this is an older book. But think of like Alex Gladstein's IMF, World Bank discussion points being a very high level overview of like how advanced economies have basically completely corrupted and taken over all these smaller nation states through the World Bank and the IMF. So his thesis, he has multiple writings and multiple books on this that I would also recommend, but the inner workings of like how it was actually done at the worker bee level is this book that I'm recommending, the Economic Hitman book. So I think those two, Alex's work and this other book go really well hand in hand for people if they're really trying to understand like, how did all of this take place? How did all of this kind of manifest itself over the last, 40 years or so? And if you read some of that stuff, it's going to just blow your mind. You're not even going to believe what you're reading.
I love that. The Economic Hitman. I'll put that in the show notes as well if people want to check that out. So Preston, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Why don't you tell people, I guess, who don't know yet, maybe where they could find some more of your work and some more of your stuff.
Thanks for having me, Brandon. I really enjoyed the chat. If people want to go to our podcast, as We Study Billionaires, I have a Bitcoin show that comes out in that feed every Wednesday. I'm very active on Twitter, just my first and last name, Preston Pish. And thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely recommend his show and the We Study Billionaires. It's actually what helped Orange Pill me. So thank you for all that you do. And
thank you, Brandon.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.